Welcome to Gastrointestinal Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. At a recent CME meeting during the GI Symposium in Orlando, we polled the audience to find out which tumor type they were most interested to hear about. And number one on the list was gastric cancer, and I'm guessing we wouldn't have obtained the same response a year ago prior to the stunning presentation at the ASCO 2009 meeting by Eric Van Cutsem of the results of the so-called TOGA trial, evaluating the use of the anti-HER2 agent trastuzumab with chemotherapy in first-line therapy of advanced disease. I met with Dr. Van Cutsem for his take on TOGA and many other areas of his research interest, including colorectal cancer, and he began our conversation by commenting on HER2-positive gastric cancer.
In the TOGA study, we went on from the assumption that the HER2 receptor may be important also in gastric cancer. We know that HER2 receptor and targeting the HER2 receptor is very important in breast cancer, and around 20 to 25% of women with breast cancer, their tumors overexpress the HER2 receptor. Well, it was known that the HER2 receptor in gastric cancer also plays an important role. There were also some preclinical data in xenografts that targeting the HER2 receptor, that this could also lead to tumor growth inhibition in these preclinical models. So with this in mind, and with also the fact that there is a lot of room for improvement for the treatment of gastric cancer, we decided to embark on a large study in which we screened patients with a gastric adenocarcinoma for HER2 positivity, and then we decided to treat patients with chemo, one of the standard options of chemotherapy for advanced or metastatic gastric cancer, without trastuzumab or with trastuzumab. And for that, we screened 3,800 patients, and 22% of these patients, which is a similar rate than in breast cancer, were HER2 positive. And then we treated these patients. We have shown that with the treatment with fluoropyrimidine plus cisplatin plus trastuzumab, that the survival was significantly longer than patients who were treated with the chemotherapy alone. And the importance of the TOGA study is that for the first time it was shown that a targeted treatment, a biological treatment, that it can impact on the outcome, on the survival of patients with metastatic gastric cancer. And two, also that with a personalized treatment, with a selection of patients, that we can also improve the outcome of patients. So it's the selection, the targeted treatment, and the enriched population that are two important aspects.
Now, the improvements that you saw in progression-free and overall survival in the study, do you see that as clinically meaningful? I mean, it's an important proof of concept, but is it enough of an improvement to think it really makes a difference in terms of patient care?
Yes, we do think that it makes a real difference. If we look in all patients, there was a median survival improvement of around 3 months with a hazard ratio of 0.74, meaning that there is a 26% improvement in the survival of patients with advanced gastric cancer. And in, like in many cancers, a hazard ratio in this range is considered clinically relevant. Of course, we want to do much better in the future. But in gastric cancer, especially in view of the fact that treatments are not very good for patients with metastatic gastric cancer, it is considered as being very important. And moreover, recently, EMEA, the European authorities who have to give approval to new drugs, they reviewed the file in detail, and what they decided is to grant approval for patients that were a bit stronger HER2 expressors. So they selected the patients that were the really strong expressors of the HER2 receptor. And with this criteria, then we see a median survival difference of more than 4 months and a hazard ratio that is below 0.70, that is in the 0.60s. And that's important. Many of the new treatments in metastatic cancer, not only in gastric cancer, but in other cancers also, usually there is an agreement that if you come in hazard ratio of below 0.70 and with medium improvement in survival of 4 months, that's considered as not only statistically significant, but also clinically clearly relevant.
What was required in terms of HER2 to be defined as positive, and what was the further analysis in terms of, quote, being strongly positive?
Initially in the trial, patients had to be with immunohistochemistry 3+ or FISH positive that were the initial criteria. And then later on, in the further analysis, to be strong positive, patient was either HER2 positive at 3 plus by immunohistochemistry, or he was 2 plus by immunohistochemistry, followed by a positive FISH test. So all these patients were 3 positive or HER2 positive, and the HER2 positives, then they were followed by showing that also the FISH test was positive. And these are very similar criteria than they are used in breast cancer these days.
And in terms of the regimen, how long was the chemo given for? And then was the trastuzumab continued after that until progression?
The protocol said that the chemo is given for a maximum of 6 cycles. And a cycle was a 3-week period, so it was 18 weeks of treatment, so 6 cycles for the chemo. And the chemo was fluoropyrimidine, either 5-FU or capecitabine, in combination with cisplatin. But trastuzumab could be continued until progression or toxicity. So in some patients, trastuzumab was continued after stopping the chemo part.
So it wasn't stipulated to continue?
It was suggested to continue unless there was toxicity or unless there was progression.
What was seen in terms of tolerability, toxicity?
Both groups of patients tolerated it quite well. There was no difference in the classic side effects of chemotherapy. I mean, with that, there was no difference in hematologic toxicity. There was no difference in nausea, vomiting. There was no difference in diarrhea. There was a small difference in cardiovascular events. But what we did in the trial is that we measured the left ventricular ejection fraction at fixed time points. And we saw that 4-5% of the patients treated with trastuzumab, that they had a small decrease in the ejection fraction compared to 1% in the control arm. So 1-4-5% in the trastuzumab arm. But this was asymptomatic in the patients. If you looked at the symptomatic cardiac adverse events, there was no difference in the two treatment groups. So that's an important message. And there is also a difference with breast cancer. In breast cancer, trastuzumab leads a bit more to symptomatic cardiac adverse events. There are two explanations for the difference between gastric and breast cancer. That is, one, many women with breast cancer who are exposed and treated with trastuzumab, they have been pretreated with an anthracycline. And we know that the combination of an anthracycline plus trastuzumab, this makes the patients a bit more at risk for cardiac adverse events. Two, unfortunately, patients with gastric cancer, their follow-up and their median survival is shorter, so that there is less time to get a decrease in the ejection fraction and to have cardiac adverse events.
What about the issue of HER2 testing, particularly as it's compared to breast cancer? I've heard it stated that maybe there's more heterogeneity in gastric cancer specimens. Is that the case?
That's correct. We still have to learn a lot, and we don't know everything because this was the first large trial in this. But it's for sure true that there is much more heterogeneity in gastric cancer compared to breast cancers. So pathologists will have to learn also if they're doing the immunohistochemistry, and there will be a learning process in this also. The strong aspect in the trial was that all the samples, the biopsies, were tested in a central lab so that, let's say, the learning curve was not an issue anymore and that there was an agreement because all the same pathologists looked at the samples in the framework of the trial. Now that the treatment is approved and that it will be implemented in clinical practice, many pathologists especially will have to learn and to deal and to appreciate some of these differences between breast and gastric cancer.
Now, you mentioned that the fraction of patients that were screened that were HER2 positive was similar to breast cancer, around 20%. And I personally found that surprising. What had we known prior to this time about HER2 positivity in gastric cancer?
There were very few data, but when we started with the trial, we started with the assumption that it would be around 20%. We see, however, some interesting differences. For instance, patients with gastroesophageal junction tumors, the G-junction tumors, they have a higher HER2 expression rate than patients with gastric cancer. In the G-junction tumors, it's more than 30% of tumors who do overexpress the HER2 receptor according to the criteria in the study. Another interesting difference is that we see it in the diffuse type of gastric cancer, that the HER2 positivity is low, it's below 10%, while it's clearly higher in the intestinal type of gastric cancers. So that are some interesting findings. And also in view of the epidemiology, that is changing. We see a decrease in gastric cancer. We see an increase in G-junction tumors. That are interesting facts that we have to take into account. In the Western world, where we see a sharp rise in G-junction tumors due to Western lifestyle, diet, more reflux disease, more obesity, the G-junction tumors are increasing. And this type of tumors have higher incidence of HER2 receptor expression. On the other hand, in the gastric cancer itself, we see a decreasing trend, but some data suggest that amongst the gastric tumors, so excluding the G-junction tumors, we see a bit more diffuse type of adenocarcinoma compared to intestinal amongst the gastric cancer. And this diffuse type has a lower incidence of HER2 receptor. So that has to be looked at in the future, clearly more in detail also.
So what's the difference between diffuse and intestinal?
That's a histologic characteristic, that's a description. The diffuse type of gastric cancer, they have more, as the word says, is also their spread is more not growing inside the stomach, less growing outside of the stomach, but more in the wall. But then they tend to give rise to metastasis quite early. And they reach often the whole stomach. They are not limited to, for instance, the distal part of the stomach, but the whole stomach. And in general, there are some data that suggest, there is not a firm proof, but there are some data that suggest that the diffuse type of gastric cancers, that they do worse when they are metastatic on chemotherapy, that their chances of response is a bit lower. And also in the diffuse type of gastric cancer without metastasis, we know that they have a worse outcome than a similar stage of an intestinal type of gastric cancer.
Now, I believe that there's a trial looking at lapatinib in gastric cancer that's going on right now. Do we know anything about other anti-HER2 agents in gastric cancer?
There are at least two large phase 3 trials ongoing with lapatinib. Many of these gastric cancer trials are recruiting in Asia because of the higher incidence of gastric cancer. There's a large trial in first line, randomized phase 3. There's a large trial in second line, also a phase 3 study ongoing with the RTC. We plan to start soon also on another trial with lapatinib in HER2-positive gastric cancer also. To my knowledge, there are no data yet available, and to my knowledge, no other large trials with other HER2 inhibitors ongoing in gastric cancer. There are some trials ongoing with the anti-EGFR antibodies in advanced gastric cancer. There is a large randomized phase 3 trial that plans to recruit more than 800 patients ongoing in different parts of the world with chemo plus or minus cetuximab, regardless of the KRAS status, because we know that gastric adenocarcinoma has a low incidence of KRAS mutations. So in the trial, there will be retrospective investigation of the KRAS status, but the trial, the population is not enriched for KRAS in this setting. And then also in the UK, a trial has started recently with chemo plus or minus panitumab, the other anti-EGFR antibody.
Do we know anything about single agent activity with either cetuximab or panitumumab?
There are very few data with cetuximab. We have some data from early studies, phase 1/2 studies, where as well with cetuximab, as with matuzumab, that's another similar antibody, a humanized antibody that is now stopped for further development, where a single agent, there were some responses seen. It's too difficult because the sample size and because the setting of the trial, phase 1, phase 2, to give you a precise number, what is the activity as single agent of an anti-EGFR antibody in this setting? To my knowledge, there are no trials reported yet with trastuzumab, single agent, in gastric cancer. There are some plans, and if I'm correctly informed, some small phase 2 studies have started with single agent, but no data yet.
In terms of anti-HER therapy again, what about adjuvant trials and any thought about combining, for example, lapatinib and trastuzumab, which of course is being looked at in breast cancer?
That's a very interesting and, of course, a very important topic. If we could do an adjuvant trial of chemo plus or minus trastuzumab or lapatinib, we could potentially have an impact. And different groups, different parts of the world are planning these trials. Trials have not yet started, but the plan is to start later this year some trials in this situation. To my knowledge, and your question is completely right, to my knowledge, there are no plans with the combination of trastuzumab and lapatinib, or no trials have started yet. Sure, not in the adjuvant setting. There are different options also, like in breast cancer. We have some data with pertuzumab, that's a newer antibody, with TDM, that's trastuzumab combined with the chemotherapy. So some of these plans are evolving, but since the data are very new, and the discussion and the agreement of, let's say, a new trial takes some time. Trials have not yet started, but the plans are being refined and fine-tuned at the moment.
It's really fascinating to think about TDM1 in gastric cancer. It's been so interesting in terms of how that's been evolving in breast cancer. So it's just being discussed, but not ready to actually be implemented.
Correct. That's correct, yes.
What about in the neoadjuvant gastric setting?
Yeah, if you discuss the topic of adjuvant and the adjuvant setting, we have almost 3 handbooks worldwide. In Japan, the standard in patients with resectable gastric cancer after resection, and the Japanese consider that they have to do at least a D2, eventually a D3 resection, so an extensive lymph node resection, is an adjuvant treatment with oral S1 for 1 year. S1 is not available in the US, it's not available in Europe. The large FLEX trial that was headed up by Jafarajani failed to show superiority of S1 cisplatin versus 5-FU cisplatin in metastatic gastric cancer. Therefore, S1 is not available in the West. So in Japan, the adjuvant treatment is adjuvant S1 for 1 year. In Europe, the consensus is based on the MAGIC study and based also on a French study to give perioperative chemo. So we usually give, and that's what I do also my patients with locally advanced gastric cancer, but resectable, a few months, 2 months of chemo before the operation, do the resection, and then 2 months of chemo after the operation. That's the so-called perioperative chemotherapy. In the US, as you know, one of the standard options is for sure based on Jack McDonald's excellent study to give adjuvant chemoradiotherapy after the operation. So there are 3 different views. There are no comparisons between the different options in this situation. And therefore, a potential strategy for the anti-HER2 antibodies could be to design a perioperative treatment regimen and trial with chemo plus trastuzumab versus chemo alone in this setting. A similar trial is ongoing in the UK with bevacizumab, chemo plus or minus bevacizumab, and then the chemo and the bevacizumab is given before and after the operation. So we could think of a similar type of design. And one of these ideas is on the shelf, on the discussion, and on the blackboard to draw concretely the trial in this situation.
I guess there's been the speculation that trastuzumab might be, quote, radiosensitizing in patients with HER2-positive breast cancer. I think they're doing a trial on a couple doses of trastuzumab with DCIS right now. Any discussion about using trastuzumab concurrent with chemoradiation and gastric cancer?
At least we in Europe haven't been discussing this topic. I haven't heard of any discussions in this situation, in this setting. I'm not aware, of course, whether some groups are starting to discuss that idea, that excellent idea, but at least to my knowledge, it hasn't been disclosed in public. I think this trial is important because in gastric cancer, we have, in fact, 4 different cytotoxics. That's the fluoropyrimidines, 5-FU, capecitabine, or in Asia, S1. 2, it's the platinum, cisplatin or oxaliplatin, both have a similar activity. That's the taxanes, and as well docetaxel as paclitaxel are active. The evidence from docetaxel comes from phase 3 studies. Paclitaxel is only phase 2 studies. And the 4th agent that is active is irinotecan. We don't have any other active agents in gastric cancer. And if you look at the data with either a doublet, either a triplet of these 4 agents, we think we have reached a plateau of median survival in advanced gastric cancer, with median survivals of around 10, 11 months, some data, some trials, 12 months. I do think that it's unlikely that with adding new cytotoxics or with changing the regimens, changing the combinations, that we will further improve. So in gastric cancer, therefore, the TOGA trial is important because it's the first trial with a biological. We hope that much more will come so that we can further improve the outcome. Because if we want to improve the outcome of patients with metastatic gastric cancer, it probably has to come from a combination from cytotoxics plus one or a few biologicals. There's still a long way to go, but several are under investigation right now today.
Do you think we're moving towards a situation where when you have targeted therapy where you're going to focus more on whether the target is present as opposed to what the primary tumor is? And for example, do you think at some point we'll start treating people with anti-HER therapy who have lung cancer and other tumors where there's such a small fraction of HER2 positivity you can't really do a trial?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And that's what we feel, that we're moving really across tumor types towards the target. It's not so easy than we would initially think, because there are for sure, even HER2 positive gastric cancer is different from an HER2 positive breast cancer. And just to lump, let's say, breast and gastric cancer in one basket, if they are HER2 positive, there are probably other factors. And cancer, it's not one receptor that plays a role. There is a whole pattern and a whole panel of different genes that are crucial and that play an important role. But that's for sure an idea that is driving science also in this probably next generation biologicals. Probably not yet with the biologicals that we have today. I don't see us doing, let's say, trials with the classic biologicals that we have today across tumor types, and that we say, for instance, let's take a KRAS wild type tumor, let's take a HER2 positive tumor. But you could think of some other examples, although we will understand that a bit more. For instance, the BRAF inhibitors. We have seen at the last ASCO and ECHO-ESMO meetings some very exciting data in patients with metastatic melanoma that had a mutation in a BRAF gene. And in these, as a small trial, phase 1b trial in around 20 patients, 70% of the patients, so almost 3 out of 4 of the patients with the BRAF mutation, with metastatic melanoma, had an objective response. Whether that will be true across different tumor types, that's not clear today. Yet we will see probably some data of initial experience at the ASCO meeting of BRAF inhibitors in BRAF mutant colorectal cancer. We know that 6 to 10% of patients with colorectal cancer have a BRAF mutation. But whether these BRAF inhibitors will also play a similar role and have a similar activity in BRAF mutant colon cancers than in BRAF mutant melanomas, that's not clear, because there is a BRAF mutation. But in this signal transduction pathways, this networking and feedback loops may be completely different in different tumor types. For instance, in melanoma and colon cancer, another example, and this is also the KRAS story. We know that KRAS mutant tumors, metastatic colorectal cancer at least, are resistant to cetuximab. The story, the KRAS story, is not the same in lung cancer. We don't understand completely why, but these are facts. So with this generation drugs, it's not so clear. We have to learn a bit more before we can change completely the paradigm and forgetting, let's say, the organ and going only to the target.
And of course, you're talking about Keith Flaherty's presentation in the melanoma. And I think thyroid also, I think, has some patients with the BRAF mutation. You mentioned bevacizumab in gastric cancer. What do we know about that, and where is that heading?
Bevacizumab, there is a very good rationale to study angiogenesis inhibitors in gastric cancer. We have preclinical data. We have also several phase 2 data. Emani Shah from Memorial Sloan has had a phase 2 study with cisplatin irinotecan plus bevacizumab, non-randomized study, phase 2 study, but with a median survival of more than 12 months with a response rate of more than 60%. Again, it's phase 2. Recently, we saw also at the last GI cancer symposium, the ASCO GI meeting, also a few other phase 2 studies with chemo backbone, for instance, also from Memorial Sloan, the modified docetaxel cisplatin 5-FU plus bevacizumab phase 2 experience with a median survival of more than 15 months, also a response rate of 60%. There is a large phase 3 study that is finished recruitment, and 700 patients have been randomized in this study of capecitabine cisplatin versus capecitabine cisplatin bevacizumab. Survival was the primary endpoint. Data will be presented at ASCO. There was very recently a press release telling us that the trial did not meet the primary endpoint of showing a survival difference. The press release, because of embargoes and so on, does not tell us more. So we will see the data at ASCO soon. But of course, looking at the press release, many were a bit disappointed that the trial does not meet the primary endpoint. And the hurdle was high in the trial. The aim was to show an important survival difference, and that was not met.
I guess in breast cancer, it's been said that the HER2-positive tumors tend to have VEGF more upregulated. There's a major adjuvant study looking at trastuzumab and bevacizumab with chemotherapy. Do we know anything about VEGF and angiogenesis in gastric HER2-positive tumors?
I don't have any data specifically in this subgroup of angiogenesis in HER2-positive patients. We have collected tumor material in the TOGA study, unfortunately not of all patients, but we have tumor material from some patients, and that's one of the questions that we are looking at the moment, but there are no data available yet. And that's, of course, a very important question.
Let's talk a little bit about colorectal cancer, and particularly things that have developed over the last year or so in terms of clinical research, beginning with a treatment in the adjuvant setting. Anything that's come out over the past year that you think it's important for physicians in practice to know about?
A couple of important aspects have come out. If you just look at the standard treatment is 5-FU oxaliplatin, that's accepted, that's shown a few years ago, especially for stage 3 colon cancer. More recently, we have seen some data also, as we could expect, that the combination of capecitabine and oxaliplatin is also active. So it's now accepted that capecitabine and oxaliplatin is an adequate substitute for 5-FU oxaliplatin in the adjuvant setting. The second important fact is looking at biologicals. And there are 4 large trials ongoing, 2 with bevacizumab, 2 with cetuximab. The first trial with bevacizumab was reported at ASCO, the NSBP trial by Norman Woolmark, which showed disappointing results, primary endpoint showing a benefit in disease-free survival when patients were treated with chemo plus bevacizumab was not met. There was a trend towards a better disease-free survival when patients were treated with FOLFOX bevacizumab compared to FOLFOX alone. But this difference was mainly during the treatment of bevacizumab, and that's interesting. The design of the study was that the chemo was given for 6 months and bevacizumab for another 6 months, so for 1 year. And during that period of treatment with bevacizumab, we saw that there was a bigger difference. Later on, the difference disappeared and vanished over time. So that's why the trial was negative. With this fact, you could take the leap that we have to look in longer treatment periods of bevacizumab to see whether 2 years of bevacizumab can benefit patients. There are some plans, there are some discussions again. But before such a trial will start, I believe we will first look at the data of the non-US trial, the AVANT trial, which was a trial in 3,500 patients, high-risk stage 2 and stage 3 colon cancer. Patients were randomized between FOLFOX, FOLFOX bevacizumab, or capecitabine oxaliplatin bevacizumab. If this trial is clearly positive for bevacizumab, then the fate of, let's say, bevacizumab in the adjuvant setting will be different than if the trial is negative. If the trial doesn't show any difference at all between yes or no bevacizumab, then I guess it's probably the end of the story of bevacizumab in the adjuvant setting. If the trial shows same effect than the NSABP-COA trial, telling us that there is a difference why patients are treated and the difference vanishes, then it may well be that it's an adequate type of question to look at longer duration of treatment. If, of course, we can afford it, because that will be an expensive treatment in this situation. The second class of agents or agent is cetuximab. Cetuximab is studied in 2 large trials in the adjuvant setting. Both trials are running in stage 3. In the US, there is an intergroup trial of FOLFOX plus or minus cetuximab. In Europe, we have done the PETAC-A trial of FOLFOX plus or minus cetuximab in stage 3 colon cancer. Both trials focus on the KRAS wild-type patients. The US trial results have not yet been presented in detail, but again, there was a press release recently telling us that there was no difference in favor of patients treated with cetuximab. The data of the European trial are expected soon, not yet at ASCO 2010, but in the near future after ASCO 2010. So again, some disappointment in the adjuvant treatment with the biologicals, also with cetuximab in the KRAS wild-type population. And then, but not yet with practical implications, we have learned also that in colon cancer, we probably have to try to select out patients. There's a lot of discussion on gene profiles. There are some commercial tests available. They need some further validation, but they are coming through, and I'm convinced that within a couple of years, we will be able to find, let's say, a gene profile, a genomic signature for colon cancer, like in breast cancer, where we have made a bit more progress already. But colon cancer is coming close and making progress also that we can select, especially in stage 2, that may be more useful in stage 2 than in stage 3 colon cancer. If we can come up with a high-risk profile based on a gene signature, then we could select and target these patients, because there are for sure patients with stage 2 colon cancer that benefit from an adjuvant treatment, and there are for sure also patients that do not need an adjuvant treatment.
With regard to genomic profiling, can you comment on the presentation at the last ASCO meeting where the Oncotype colon assay was presented on patients from the QUASAR study? Could you explain what the QUASAR study was and then what was presented there?
The QUASAR study was an English study, and there are different QUASAR studies, and QUASAR stands for the pragmatic type of English studies. They did a large study in stage 2 colon cancer, or even more precise, in patients with uncertain indication for chemotherapy, where there were a few stage 1 and a few stage 3, but the majority were stage 2 colon cancer. And then this group reported that with a 5-FU-based treatment, so without oxaliplatin, that there was a small but statistically significant benefit for an adjuvant 5-FU-based chemotherapy. The difference was significant because of the large sample size. It was, if you look in the 5-year survival, around 3% benefit. So this indicates us that some patients do need and some patients don't need an adjuvant treatment. But in general, there was a significant difference in the trial. And so based on this data set and this assumption, the English investigators have been looking also at the genomic profile. And what they presented at the last ASCO meeting is a whole panel of different genes. It's not one gene. It's not as simple as KRAS mutant or wild type, but it's a combination of different genes so that you come up with a signature. And that if patients have a certain signature, that they may have a better prognosis. Other patients with the other signature may have a worse prognosis. So it's prognostic signature. It's a retrospective analysis, but it's a very good study, and it's clearly hypothesis generating. There is a lot of discussion whether that should now be implemented in clinical practice. It can give with an individual patient who wants to know a bit more numbers and data on his outcome. It can help the physician in this interaction. In my country, in Belgium, the test is not commercially available, so we cannot use it today, and I don't use it today. But it's interesting. Again, it's not black and white, but it can be one of the factors on top of the microscopy, like in stage 2. Classically in stage 2, we try to determine and to distinguish high-risk stage 2, low-risk stage 2. High-risk stage 2 that we tend to treat more with adjuvant chemotherapy, low-risk stage 2 that I don't usually treat with adjuvant chemotherapy, and high versus low-risk stage 2. Today, we base that on some microscopic criteria. If a patient has a low number of lymph nodes that have been removed, less than 12 usually. If a patient has a poorly differentiated adenocarcinoma, vascular invasion, perineural invasion, lymphatic vessel invasion, an obstruction at the initial presentation, a stage 2 tumor with a T4, so a T4N0 tumor, a high CA level are the different criteria that put us in the poor group, so in the high-risk stage 2, while the other criteria put the patients in the good prognostic or low-risk stage 2. And that's what we do usually. This genomic signature, at least with the data as we have seen them today, can add one extra factor in this differentiation and to put the patient in a different group. But again, that's not black and white.
You know, it's interesting for us as an education group, and we, of course, have been following the breast cancer story for years and the whole challenge of, you know, whether to give adjuvant therapy when maybe you're looking at a couple percent or a few percent difference. But one difference in colon cancer I see is that you have available, you know, in breast cancer, you're going to get a taxane or anthracycline, you know, major chemotherapy, intravenous chemotherapy. But in colon cancer, you have the option of capecitabine alone, which seems like it might be something to think about if your benefit is borderline. Do you ever utilize capecitabine alone, particularly in the lower risk adjuvant situation?
Yes, we have some data with capecitabine, that capecitabine is as good as 5-FU in the adjuvant setting. And in patients with a relatively low chance of relapse, and especially then I'm thinking of the stage 2, but the high-risk stage 2, usually we don't treat these patients with a platinum, we treat them with a fluoropyrimidine. And then it's obvious that capecitabine is at least as good and is more convenient for the patient than intravenous 5-FU. In stage 3 colon cancer, there the data are so strong that at least if the patient is fit to tolerate the combination chemotherapy, that platinum, oxaliplatin, is being added to the treatment. And there we have two options. That's either 5-FU oxaliplatin, capecitabine oxaliplatin is also an option. There was a recent study presented for the first time at the ECCO-ESMO meeting in Berlin 2009, where it was shown that capecitabine oxaliplatin in this group of patients is clearly better than 5-FU. It was not a head-to-head comparison of FOLFOX versus capecitabine oxaliplatin, but we have seen many of these comparisons in metastatic. So based on these different data, it is also an option in the patients. But monotherapy capecitabine, yes, is an option, and it can replace in the lower risk 5-FU.
How do you approach dosing and schedule, for that matter, when you use monotherapy with capecitabine in the adjuvant setting?
It probably matters, and that's, again, an important and interesting question. We have published with the group, and Dan Haller was the lead author of that in the GCO, that dosing may be slightly, that at least tolerance is different in the U.S. versus European patients, and again, versus Asian patients. We don't have a complete explanation for that. There are some suggestions that in the U.S., because of the folate supplements in the food, that this may be, it's not proven, but that this may be the explanation why the tolerance of capecitabine is a bit less optimal in the U.S. than non-U.S. patients, because leucovorin in general and so the folates potentiate the effect of capecitabine. So that's a hypothesis that's not proven. So in this situation, of course, we have to give the optimal dose. Underdosing in adjuvant treatment should not be done. When I treat a patient, I usually start with a dose of 1250 milligrams per meter square twice daily, 2 weeks on, 1 week off. My US colleagues sometimes start a little bit lower, which is probably okay in view of some of these data that have been published also in the GCO.
There's been discussion about a 1 week on, 1 week off regimen, both in breast and colon cancer. What are your thoughts about that?
Correct. There are some data in colon cancer also, 1 week off, 1 week on treatment. The experience is not so widespread. The official registration studies and phase 3 studies have been done with the classical regimen, 2 weeks on, 1 week off. But it seems, at least from the different phase 2 studies, that 1 week off and 1 week on can be also an option. I usually don't do it. I don't have any personal experience. But if you look at the data, also in colon cancer, then it's for sure an acceptable and good strategy.
Let's talk a little bit about management of advanced disease. And one area that you've been very involved with is patients with colorectal cancer and resectable liver metastases and the controversy about preoperative therapy versus postoperative therapy. Can you provide an update on that area?
Again, if we see patients with liver metastases only, it's important to look up front at what is the strategy in these patients. You have to determine, is it a patient who has resectable disease or not resectable disease? Because that may drive the decision what we do. And that always has to be discussed in a multidisciplinary team with the surgeon and the oncologist. But in patients that are deemed to be resectable up front, there was a large ERTC intergroup randomized phase 3 study that we published last year in The Lancet, where we randomized patients between surgery alone, because they were resectable, or perioperative chemo, 3 months of FOLFOX before and 3 months of FOLFOX after the operation. And it was shown that progression-free survival was lower in patients with surgery alone, so was longer in patients treated with perioperative chemotherapy. Based on that, in Europe, we often adopt a strategy, and that's also what I do in my clinical practice, a strategy of perioperative chemo, 3 months before and 3 months after the operation. On an evidence-based data set, we cannot tell that this strategy is better than a strategy of doing surgery and then 6 months of chemotherapy. Nick Petrelli defended that strategy. In the US, there are plans for a trial to look in the strategy of perioperative chemotherapy versus postoperative chemotherapy, but that will take some time before we have these data. There are advantages for both strategies. For the perioperative, it can allow you to determine the sensitivity. Chemotherapy is usually better tolerated before than after the operation, and you give some of the chemotherapy before the operation. It can help you to select patients also that anyway will have rapid progression, and that will be anyway, if you resect them immediately, not good candidates. On the other hand, going for immediate surgery followed by postoperative chemotherapy allows you to do a bit better staging by the surgeon during the operation and to have this more adequately done. So there are, let's say, arguments for both strategies. But we believe in Europe with many of the opinion leaders that the perioperative is a good strategy, and that's what I do in my clinical practice in most of the patients, not in all patients. Patients, for instance, where I don't do it is a patient who presents 4 years after the initial operation, so with a metachronous, solitary, small metastasis. That's a patient that has to be resected. These patients probably don't need perioperative chemotherapy. But a patient presenting with synchronous metastasis or metastasis shortly after his initial presentation of the primary tumor, or patients with several but resectable metastases, patients with 4 or 5 metastases but deemed to be resectable, in this group of patients, I do propose a perioperative chemotherapy.
What do we know about the use of biologics, either EGFR antibodies or bevacizumab, in the neoadjuvant or post-resection situation, and do you utilize them in your own practice?
There's a lot to say about that, and we can talk for a long time about the use of biologicals in the perioperative setting. Here it's very important to distinguish the resectable and the non-resectable patients. In resectable, upfront resectable patients, evidence-based medicine and the data tell us that we don't have any data that we should add biologicals. It may be true that biologicals further improve the outcome. There are some studies ongoing, relatively small studies. There are some studies planned in the resectable patients, but we do not have the data. So if you look at the real evidence, there chemo is the standard option. Some physicians, and more in the US than in Europe, add in this situation also a biological bevacizumab in this situation, but we don't have the data yet today. Then there is a second group of patients with not resectable liver metastasis. And there we have to go for the strategy. Do we think if we have a nice response that we can potentially resect that? And that is to be discussed up front with the multidisciplinary team, surgeons and oncologists. If these patients become resectable, then this can mean something for them, because we know that a patient that was initially not resectable who becomes resectable, that this outcome is almost as good as a patient who was initially resectable. There are some data from René Adam's group in this situation. So therefore, it's important in this group of patients with initially not resectable metastasis to give him the best chemo upfront. And in this situation, the best regimen upfront is a combination of 2 cytotoxics plus a biological. And therefore, we don't have head-to-head studies which biological is the best in this situation. There are data with, as well, bevacizumab. There are data with cetuximab. What is clear is that we can do the operation safe after the administration of the biologicals. Cetuximab probably has no impact on wound healing and so on. Bevacizumab has no clear impact on wound healing and can be administered safe, and surgery can be done safe after the administration of bevacizumab, as long as we wait long enough after the last administration of bevacizumab. We usually wait 6 weeks in this situation.
So in that situation where you're hoping to convert a patient to resectability and the tumor is KRAS wild, I've heard people say that they prefer an EGFR antibody because the response rate is better. I mean, obviously that's indirect, but do you buy into that?
Yes, I agree with that. The data are indirect. There are no direct comparisons yet available in this setting. But the indirect data suggests that in especially the situation of conversion, where we want to make a non-resectable disease resectable, that the addition of cetuximab in KRAS wild-type patients makes the chance a bit higher than with bevacizumab. Bevacizumab is a better agent, a better progression-delaying agent. Cetuximab can induce a bit more responses in the KRAS wild-type patients.
In reference to EGFR antibodies, what's your take on panitumumab versus cetuximab? Basically the same, or do you see any differences?
There is never a head-to-head study, but if you look in the cross-trial comparisons, we have a bit more data in later lines in this situation. If you look at cetuximab single agent in chemorefractory patients or panitumumab single agent, and the response rate or progression-free survival, it's very similar. There is probably not a big difference in activity between these drugs. And I think comparing these two drugs in head-to-head comparison is a waste of energy and a waste of time and a waste of money in the trials. We can do much better for the patients. So both are options for the patients, and we cannot say that one of them is clearly better than the other. We have a bit more data with cetuximab in different lines of treatment than with panitumumab. We had also the data in later lines of treatment that cetuximab irinotecan was better than cetuximab alone. We didn't have these data with panitumumab, but recently we have seen also some data with panitumumab in combination with the FOLFIRI regimen, for instance, in second line, that showed that it also increases the activity. So probably both agents have a very similar activity.
I guess in the United States, the one issue would be in certain geographic areas, North Carolina, Tennessee, you see a lot of infusion reactions to cetuximab. In those areas, they're using panitumumab. What about worldwide? Any other sort of areas where you see a lot of infusion reactions?
In Europe, we don't see very frequent infusion reactions. I'm aware of that region in the US, but that's not the case in Europe, and I'm not aware of any other regions in the world where that's the case, these infusion reactions after cetuximab.
Any new data sets coming out in colorectal cancer that oncologists in practice should be looking for?
We expect to see some data, and I contributed also to that with small molecule tyrosine kinase inhibitors in colorectal cancer. We have ended phase 3 program with sidrenib AZD2171 in colon cancer. We have done a large randomized phase 3 study in first line, the so-called Horizon study of FOLFOX, bevacizumab versus FOLFOX sidrenib. We expect to see also some data, although the analysis is event-driven, but we expect to see some data at the ASCO meeting.
Now, sidrenib, is that purely a VEGF TKI, or does it affect other pathways?
It affects a few other pathways, yes.
And what do we know about it up to this point in colorectal cancer?
We have seen data from a small randomized phase 2 study in second line, head-to-head with bevacizumab, no significant difference in phase 2, small study, a trend towards slightly lower activity compared to bevacizumab. This was presented, it's not yet full published, was presented at the previous ASCO meeting. But the phase 3 study will give us the, let's say, more final data, and that study will be reported first. There is another study where patients are randomized of FOLFOX plus or minus sidrenib that will also be reported in the near future. I'm not sure whether it will be reported at ASCO. I'm not involved in that last study. I'm involved in the first study, but I'm not presenting it.
What's seen in terms of side effects and tolerability with sidrenib? Is it like bevacizumab? Hypertension, etc.?
Yes, many of these side effects are class effects, like hypertension, some proteinuria, thrombosis. The exact numbers we will know more if we see the data of the phase 3 study, of course. And then there may be, but we will see that also more in detail, some diarrhea, the small molecules, VEGF tyrosine kinase inhibitors, that's also seen with some other molecules, sometimes give a bit more diarrhea, so some different adverse events than does bevacizumab. So everything will have to be balanced in view of the efficacy, of course.
If it turns out that there is efficacy in the advanced disease setting, how do you see it playing out potentially in the adjuvant setting? You were talking about, you know, the CO8 bevacizumab adjuvant trial and people talking about giving it for 2 or longer years. And, of course, there's the cost issue, but also there's the side effects and intravenous administration. Do you think that in the long run, a anti-angiogenic TKI like cediranib maybe would fit better in the adjuvant setting?
In theory, it may fit better, of course, if a patient has to take it for 2 or 3 years, and if he can take tablets instead of coming every couple of weeks for an injection of intravenous bevacizumab. But there's still a long way before we can design these trials. First, we have to see that it's really at least as good or even better than bevacizumab. 2, toxicity in the metastatic studies have to be looked at carefully, and then especially also long-term toxicity. We don't know, and some people have some concerns also of long-term toxicity of TKIs, and especially if you embark then in a type of trial you suggest of 2 or 3 years, that's still a long way. And the other, let's say, condition for that is also that the event study that we talked earlier about, that this has also to show the same trend, let's say the same clinical message, that when you take, as long as you take an angiogenesis inhibitor, you see the benefit, and then after you stop, it vanishes, it goes away. This has also to be the case. So there are still some conditions before we can embark on that. Many of this information will be available within the next 6 to 12 months so that we can discuss that through one of our next talks, Neil.